Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Take one Greek scholar, add a pastor and seminary professor, times eight nonfiction books, and you have my guest, William J. Carle. He's author of Assassin's Manuscript. It's an atypical espionage story, a suspenseful, action-packed international thriller about a one-time CIA assassin who left his trade to become a minister, only to be called upon to return to his old life to uncover and stop a global terrorist plot. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about William J. Carle, go to LacanPublishing.com, and you can follow him on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. And William, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Ira. Good to see you.
Thank you. With your background, why did you decide to write this kind of a book? It's an interesting twist on what you normally think about in the world of pastors and spies and everything in between.
Well, that's right. I was sitting in my office one day in Dallas, Texas. I had been a professor before, and at the time, I was a pastor of a large church in downtown Dallas. And Alex Haley, the author of Roots, who was a friend of our family, had come to speak at a big town hall forum. And I was sitting there and he said, "Have you written anything?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, let me see one of your books." So I pulled one off the shelf, which was a set of lectures I'd given at Princeton. So Alex Haley, the author of Roots, is now thumbing and reading sections of the book I had published, one of them. And that book, by the way, has been reprinted and had translated into Korean, and I've gone to Seoul to deal with that. Anyway, he sits there and he looks up and he says, "Bill, you need to write a novel." I said, "Alex, what makes you say that?" He said, "Two things. One, you know how to write and you write really well." Now, this is the author of Roots telling me I write really well. And you know how to tell a story. And that's all a novel is. So I said, "Well, what kind of novel would I write?" And he said, "What do you like?" And I said, "Oh, I like Tom Clancy, Robert Ludlum, you know, the Jason Bourne, Jack Ryan, international espionage." He goes, "Write one like that." I said, "Alex, I don't know that much about those. That's not my world." He said, "Well, you're a Greek scholar and you know about old manuscripts. Why don't you put that together with international espionage?" So that's what I did. And it's this novel, it's called Assassin's Manuscript, as you mentioned earlier, is a Dan Brown meets Daniel Silva thriller. So those two genres come together. Now, you would think, why would you do that? Well, I love these kind of genres. And I just like doing research, so I did the research, and 30 years later, Ira, 30 years later, and 12 revisions, it's done, and it's out there.
Will you confess for the first time that you also are secretly a member of the CIA?
You know, what's funny is, on other interviews, funny you ask that, Ira, because on other interviews, people will go, "Wait a minute, this is a former CIA assassin who becomes a minister and moves to Maryville, Tennessee," which is where I live in retirement right now. And they all ask, "Is this autobiographical?" And I will answer, "Well, you know, all writing is autobiographical." And then pause while they look a little scared. And then I said, "Oh, and also when I was trained in theological school, we had an extracurricular course called Taekwondo Karate that was to handle rough parishioners. So I had 3 years of Taekwondo, and I'm able to describe the action scenes in my novel with that." But no, I've never worked for the CIA, and I've certainly never killed anyone.
Well, I have to say, I usually don't have fiction writers on because I love nonfiction more than I love fiction. My sister loves fiction. I love nonfiction. My wife likes everything. But I wanted to talk to you because of your unique background and the fact that you came up with this hero, Adam Hunter. And before we even get into that, though, I have to tell you, I'm listening to you and I'm watching. And for those who are only listening, you look way too young to be retired. Let me put it that first. Okay. So number two, unless you had recent surgery done by the CIA and its Department of Plastic Surgery, I don't know. But the other thing is your voice and accent and the way you present yourself reminds me of very much evangelist.
Well,
especially one that would be on television preaching to the flock.
I I think evangelist is a little bit strong because I'm a Presbyterian, which is a very much more liberal, progressive denomination. But I was on TV in Texas every third Sunday to 500,000 people all over the state. And so, you know, it might come across sounding a little that way. But
well, I was saying evangelist, not from the point of view of religion, as more as from a performance standpoint. So you confirmed it by saying you were on television.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I sang opera in college. I was Antonio the Drunken Gardener in The Marriage of Figaro. Great part for a future pastor. You know, someone has broken my flower pot, you know, and such. But it is interesting to think about the fact that here is a, why is this minister writing this novel about an espionage character? And I've just always been fascinated with these kinds of characters. Now, I will say this is not, Ira, not a typical good guys and bad guys. You know, in many of the Clancy novels, the Americans are all good guys and Arabs or whoever are all the bad guys. Not in my novel. In my novel, I don't know if it's Augustine or who said that there is good in every evil person and evil in every good one. We're all a mix. So all my characters are broken and flawed. Doesn't matter who it is. I have a female president who is Hispanic named Victoria Sanchez. She's the first female, the third Catholic, and the first Hispanic president. And all the way through, you can't tell, is she good or bad? And many of the characters, you can't quite tell, is this a good character or a bad character? And you have to read all the way to the end to figure it out. So like nonfiction. You like nonfiction.
Correct.
And that's my world, is nonfiction. 8 nonfiction books. I started publishing in 1979. I can roll out of bed and write a nonfiction book. But this is a whole different world, fiction. Ooh, it's so different.
Did you do any nonfictional research for this book? And what I mean by that is, did you go up to D.C. and Virginia and knock on doors of intelligence agencies to get some background or talk to some people that gave you some insight that you didn't have before?
I did lots of research. Now, I have a PhD in rhetoric and communication from the University of Pittsburgh. And when you do a PhD, you have to do lots of research because you become the world's authority on that one subject. Well, I traveled to 7 foreign countries, which are all in the novel. Went to Toronto, London, Rome, Russia, Jerusalem, St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai. And many of my reviewers have said the descriptions are so exquisite. Well, that's because I went there.
Right.
In fact, the only place I didn't go, Ira, was the papal apartment because I didn't know the Pope. However, I knew 2 people who did. One scholar in New York, and one was the bishop of our diocese in Texas. And I just sat down with them and took notes. I like to take notes. I like to listen and learn. And that's how I did that research. But I did research on the assassins, too. I don't know if you want to hear that story.
I mean, I do, but because you didn't quite answer my question, I'm always very good about remembering what is not answered. And my question.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Did you, in essence, whether it was the CIA or some other intelligence agency, did you visit any of their agents or operatives to get the sense of what it was like to work in that environment?
Yes. Not up there, but a friend who had retired in Texas, Buck Revell, was number 2 at the FBI in charge of counterterrorism and counterintelligence. And Buck Revell is Tom Clancy and Frederick Forsyth's main consultant on all their CIA-type novels. He was my main consultant as well. So I got more than you could imagine on the CIA part. Yeah, he's got a cybersecurity company now himself. And he wrote an autobiography called G-Man about his experience at the FBI, but of a huge guy. You wouldn't want to be arrested by him. And I mean, he's an amazing person. And he was so helpful. He just gave me all kinds of details about how to write the CIA part.
What was the biggest challenge writing the book? You mentioned traveling to all these different countries, talking to a lot of people to get the flavor and the sense of location, as well as methods and sources, all of that stuff. But what was the most challenging part of writing the book?
Well, I think it was just the writing itself, because as I said, when I write nonfiction, by the way, when I write nonfiction, my goal is to grab you from the first line and keep you all the way through the nonfiction book. I had the same goal with this, but it's a different kind of writing, Ira. I mean, it's really about plot. It's about characters. It's not about it. It's not so much about ideas, although I do have some literary depth that I'm going to mention when we talk about the main character, Adam Hunter. But to me, that was the hardest part. And so I just wrote and wrote and wrote. And the first version was 740 pages. It was like War and Peace or something, you know, way too big. I brought it into a literary agent there in Dallas, dropped it on his desk. You nearly broke my desk with that thing. Go take 200 pages out. So I did, but that was like killing your own babies. And that's hard, you know, yeah. When you've got characters, you've got to delete. However, when you do a PhD, you have to learn how to edit. And you have to learn how to tighten. Now, a friend who is also an author said, learn how to write screenplays because that'll help you tighten your novel. So sure enough, I did. And I even won the Telluride Indie Fest screenwriting contest with a romantic comedy that's a totally different type story called Maggie's Perfect Match. And I have a manager in L.A. and we're shopping it and such. And I've turned it into a play. What screenwriting does is it makes you tighten the story. For example, dialogue is much crisper in a movie or less so in a play because the plays are about dialogue. But in a movie, dialogue is very crisp. And in a book, you can end up writing too much dialogue. So the screenwriting helped me tighten. But I would say the writing was the biggest challenge. It was hard. And like I said, it took me 12 revisions. Now, Charles Cornwell, who is the former husband of Patricia Cornwell, author, and her editor, was my editor through all 12 revisions. And when we got to the last one, he said, "This is masterful. Time to go. Get it out there." I like to say on these interview and conversations, to write a great story or a novel or a screenplay or a play or a poem is to be rewritten. You can't just write it and that's it with the first draft. You have to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And Stephen King, I don't read a lot of his books, but because of the horror such in him, but he has a book on writing, Ira, called On Writing. That's the title. And easy. In it, he's a great writer. He has a great line in there. I'll never forget. To write is human, to edit is divine. So if you're any of the people listening are writers, they need to know how to have a good editor who will be honest with them. And that's what I had all the way through. By the way, you mentioned that I look younger to you than you think. I'm actually 75. I'll be 76 this year.
That's amazing.
And, you know, I picked out good parents, you know, how the genes all work. And I've spoken at Chautauqua up in Western New York, where a lot of people come from all over the
country.
Can
you say that three times real fast?
Chautauqua. Yeah. Yes. Chautauqua. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to use good diction for that. I coach people on how to speak. So I ought to be able to do that. Anyway, I've spoken there several times and, you know, there are 5,000 in the auditorium. And when he was still alive, they'd bring David McCullough and the Beach Boys used to sing there and lots of interesting people. I call it the Disney World for the chronologically mature. Because you're dodging walkers and scooters and such. And you can't get the senior citizen discount at Chautauqua until you're 90. So I have decided that the new middle age is 60 to 90. And so I'm halfway through it.
Well, yeah, but I just looking at you, I was thinking to myself, and again, the viewers can see it, but the listeners can't. You look way too young to be retired, and you're not really retired. You're still writing and, as you say, rewriting and editing. So, and I like the way you said editing is divine because given your background as a pastor, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Sorry to get you in the middle of a drinking
that's
coffee.
Okay. That's okay. That was Stephen King who said that. And I don't know.
No, I know. But the fact that you're a pastor and it's divine makes perfect sense to me. So that's how it
does. Out. It does. Yes. Well, I've spoken at many prominent synagogues around the country in about 40 states in terms of churches and a dozen foreign countries. So, yeah, okay. To edit is divine. That's good. And, you know, if I get theological, one of the great Greek words in the New Testament is workmanship. And the word in Greek is poiema. So what the Apostle Paul is saying, we are God's poems, because Aristotle uses poiema in his Aristotle's Poetics. And so, you know, God is writing the poems of our lives every day, you know, rewriting. Some of us are sonnets, some of us are trite couplets, some of us are limericks. You got to be careful how far you go with the image. But yeah, to edit.
And then, of course,
mind.
Plato was busy writing in the cave. So it works all
there you go.
Very well.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So I want to get back to your book, though. And it's a wonderful conversation we're having because we go in and out of the book, which is what I like. It doesn't have to be a linear approach to
right.
this. But when you were writing the book, and this is in the weeds question, which I occasionally ask an author, but more so with you, I'm intrigued. Because of the amount of rewriting you had to do, and you had to shrink that book from 9 million pages down to 500,000 pages, were you writing by hand, using a computer? How did it work for you?
Computer. I used to write everything by hand. My dissertation, 313 pages typed, was all written by hand. And I remember handwriting 57 pages one day just to get the dang thing done, you know. No, I create everything on a computer. Yeah, I have a keyboard, go at it, yeah. And
so
just watch the words.
You went from handwriting to computer. Did you ever use a manual or electric typewriter and then perhaps a word processor before you went from?
Oh, yeah, I went through all those stages, absolutely.
Okay.
And when I was a Greek professor, if I had it here, it's down in the garage, but I have a 1910 Underwood Greek typewriter. It's an old black thing, huge, weighs a ton. And that when I first started teaching Greek, and I always welcomed our students to the boot camp of Union Seminary. You've heard Greek is hard. It's harder than you think. Look around. There are 70 of you. 10 of you will not be here at the end. But anyway, in my 7 years teaching at that theological school in Virginia, I went from that old Greek Underwood to then a manual, nice Olympia manual, then to an electric, then to an IBM Ball.
And the Selectric, right.
Yeah, the Selectric. And then finally was getting into computers when I left there.
Right.
So
word processors and then computers. So yeah,
That's
everything.
It.
So yep. I want to get back to the book for a second, because you obviously incorporate what you know with what you relatively recently learned in order to write this book. When I say that, it means clearly your background plus talking with people in that world and traveling to all those locations that you did. What was the most surprising thing you found in your research? Even though this is fiction, what was the most surprising thing you found? Or maybe there's more than one, either in the locations you went to or the people you talked to or the things you found out. What was the most surprising thing?
Yeah, the most surprising thing was I knew I needed to understand assassins better because it's not my world.
Yeah, so I would think not.
No, it is not. And so I began just stumbling across meeting. I met two American assassins, the son of one, and one Israeli and one Russian. And I got them to talk. They weren't active as assassins anymore. It's what they used to do in a former life.
Oh, wait, William, just a minute, though. When you say assassin, though, we're just to differentiate. We're not talking about necessarily an assassin for the mob or organized crime or criminals. You're talking about assassins for, in essence, governmental bodies. Would that be correct?
In four of them, yes. But the Russian that I interviewed is a former Russian mafia chief.
Interesting. Okay.
Trained in judo, karate, and wrestling, and actually murdered people. And now he is a pastor up in the Ural Mountains. Think about that. He is like my main character. Just exactly. And one of the Americans is a former CIA hitman. Now, these were the rest of them were governmental. And he's now a librarian at a seminary in the United States. Yeah, really. And he was on an accreditation site visit team that I was chairing up in DC, and we were having dinner, and he said, "What are you working on?" And I told him, and he said, "Well, that's what I used to do." I said, "What? You got to be kidding." And he said, "Yeah, amazing. There are countries I can't go to." I was lecturing at a college. My wife doesn't want me to say the name of the college, but I was lecturing at a college. And at the end in the Q&A, they said, "What are you working on?" I told them. And one of the young men came up, and he was a philosophy professor. And he said, "Let's go have a drink." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "I want to tell you about my dad, who was a hitman for the CIA. But I didn't know it till he confessed to me on his deathbed. That's what he used to do." And he said, "You would never have guessed it, because he was a regular little league dad in the neighborhood." And then the other American was a taxi driver in Louisville, Kentucky, where I had come in for a board meeting late. And he picked me up at midnight, took me to the Brown Hotel downtown. Now, I like to talk to taxi drivers. I don't know if you ever do that, Ira. You ever talk to taxi drivers? And
I do.
Get them to talk. So this guy, I could tell.
Now, usually it's Uber or Lyft rather than taxis, but yes.
Well, yeah, right now it's Uber or Lyft. Yeah, this was years ago. And so I could tell he wasn't from Louisville, Kentucky, because he sounded like cup of coffee, you know, New York accent. So I said, "So you're from New York?" "Yeah." I said, "So when'd you come here?" "After NAM." I said, "What'd you do in NAM?" "I was in the Phoenix Project." "Well, because of my research, I knew that was a sad." So I said, "You got to pick anybody else up tonight?" He said, "No, you're my last one." I said, "If I cross your palm with a $100 bill, can we have a drink and you can tell me stories?" "Hell yeah, I hated the Viet Cong. Let's talk." Yeah. So this guy was amazing. And I just took notes and took notes. The Israeli was running a tennis tournament in Texas. And our older son's a teaching tennis pro in D.C. now and played college tennis. And he was a teenager then, and we got to talk, and this guy was handing out cans of tennis balls to the kids playing in the tournament. So we get to talking, and I find out he's from Israel, and I said, "Well, everybody in Israel has to serve in the military." He said, "Yeah." And I said, "So where, what unit?" He said, "Mossad." And I said, "Oh, which unit in Mossad?" He said, "Oh, the Kidon unit." Well, K-I-D-O-N, that's hitman. And I had done the research, so I knew that. And I said, "Okay, you got to tell me stories." And
another $100 goes from
this
you.
This guy didn't even have to cross his palm. He was ready to. It's almost like these people want to open up and tell about their experiences. Ira, he said, "I had Arafat in my sights twice, and the order to take the shot never came." That would have changed history. Now, here's the biggest surprise. That's the question you asked me. What was the biggest surprise? It was how normal these people were. These were not mean type people. These were not ugly sounding type people. These were very, it was like your next door neighbor, you know? And if you remember the movie Carlos the Jackal, where Bruce Willis plays Carlos, and toward the end, he's befriended this guy so he can get close to, I guess he's going to try to kill the vice president or something. I don't want to give away too much for those who haven't seen it. But he's gotten what he needs, and this guy's jabbering over next to him, and he's eating Chinese food watching TV. And at one point, he just gets so tired of hearing the guy, he picks up his silencer and goes thump, thump, puts his silencer back down, goes back to eating Chinese food. That's a real assassin. So I had to get inside that to be able to write my main character, who in many ways is like John Wayne in The Quiet Man, if you remember that movie.
John Ford was the director.
Yeah, a boxer in America who kills somebody in the ring. He goes to Ireland, his homeland, and he just can't fight anymore. Well, my main character, to just get back into the story, in what happens before the novel starts, has tried to kill this Bedouin terrorist in New York with a bomb, and the bomb goes off, but instead, by accident, he's killed his own wife, who's coming down the same street to surprise him, and the fiance of a woman in Tennessee, and he killed the Bedouin's girlfriend, and this is why the Bedouin gets involved. In fact, the opening chapter is called Revenge is Sweet, but Adam is conflicted through the whole, Adam Hunter is conflicted through the whole book on, I have to leave this old world behind, but he keeps getting pulled, like in The Godfather, where they pulled me back, you know. And the unlikely romance in this story is that the fiance of the young man he killed is somebody who starts getting interested in him and falls in love with him and is traipsing around the Middle East with his intrigue. And all the way through, you're wondering, is she going to find out? And if she does, what's she going to do? So I'm answering. Yeah. I'm going way too long on the answer. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I wanted our audience to get a flavor of the novel. And I think you did a good job with it. Did your wife enjoy reading?
No, she doesn't like these kind of books at all.
Thanks for your honesty. I like
that. Yeah, no, she doesn't. She doesn't like violent movies. And, you know, one reviewer said, we'll look forward to the sequel with characters that Dr. Carl did not kill off in the first book.
So in other words, your wife does not want to read Stephen King, and now your wife doesn't want to read you. So, okay.
Well, she out of love for me, read through it and said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you wrote this. But she likes my writing. It's just the story idea. Now, I want to mention one quick thing about how this is not just a beach read. I mean, I write it that way. It has very short chapters like James Patterson. And I'm easily bored, even in nonfiction books. I read lots of nonfiction books, but I'm bored very quickly. If they don't grab me quickly, I'm probably not going to read much. I may skim around if it's supposed to be really good. Well, for me, writing is, I just don't want to bore myself, right? So I write short chapters. They have a hook at each end. This is a fast-paced thriller. It just flies. However, there's literary depth here in this story. And the literary depth comes with the fact that Adam Hunter's name, well, Adam in Hebrew means humankind, and Hunter means he's in search of something. So Adam represents a violent humanity out of control in search of peace, which is kind of our world today, if you think about Ukraine and Israel, Gaza, and others. And Rennie, which is the main female character, her name is short for Irene, which in Greek means peace. So she's the only one who can complete his mythic story. And the question is, will she? Because if she ever finds out that he killed her fiance. So there is this sort of Joseph Campbell, a hero with a thousand faces, Christopher Vogler's The Writer's Journey, all the background to all the Star Wars movies, where main character has to leave ordinary world, go to extraordinary world, meet with mentor Yoda. In my case, it's Stump Stevens, who's the former CIA director, and meets his shadow self, not Darth Vader, but the Bedouin. I mean, there's this rich literary stuff going on that I never say anything about. It's just, will the reader catch it? And yet, I want them to stay with the novel because it's so interesting and such a wild story. So
that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been William J. Carl. He's author of Assassin's Manuscript. It's an atypical espionage story. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about William J. Carl, go to LeConte Publishing.com, and you can follow him on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. And William, thanks for being on the show.
Great to be with you, Ira, and I love the bagels behind you there.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.